yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to continue our refocus on the U.S. economy. We've been looking a lot at Europe and the global economy, and there's some very interesting things going on globally, and we'll come back to those in subsequent weeks. You know, most important, of course, being will Greece default on its debts here, and will it leave the Eurozone? Well, that's some real intense negotiations going on there right now in Riga, Latvia, between the European finance ministers and Greece. We'll maybe say a few things about that here when later on in the show. I think it's worthwhile just to give a little bit of update on that, because that could result in a major implosion in the Eurozone economy here. You know, it looks like the Germans are saying, okay, leave. Is that a bargaining ploy, or is that really a decision that the Germans are about to make? Well, we'll take up that theme later, but that's a potential bomb, economic bomb there in Europe that needs to be looked at very closely. And, of course, the economy, again, in Europe is slowing. Germany, France, even after this announcement earlier this year of this multi-trillion-dollar quantitative easing injection, which, of course, is boosting the stock markets, as it has everywhere, but not having that big effect on the economy. Okay, so that's Europe. The other major thing that's happening is more and more data is coming in that says China is really slowing down. And we need to look at that in the upcoming weeks. So we'll continue looking at the global situation, but we really need to refocus on the U.S. economy, because we may have a big surprise coming next week. On April 29th, we get the first preliminary view of U.S. first quarter GDP. You know, they've been hyping ever since last summer that, oh, the U.S. economy's finally taken off, 5% GDP growth here last third quarter. And a few weeks ago, I gave a preliminary view of that and pointed out some reasons why that third quarter of last year was really not a general trend and wasn't going to continue. And, of course, the GDP numbers halved again in the fourth quarter to 2.2%. But we're about to get, a nasty surprise here about the first quarter GDP. It may be zero. It may come to a full halt. And, of course, they're going to say it's the weather, yeah. So let's look at this U.S. GDP, because we're going to get the first official view that's coming here in next week. Well, by the time some of you listen online to this, it may have already been announced, first quarter GDP. Okay, I want to talk about that. But first, I want to talk about another issue relating to the U.S. economy. So two parts today on the U.S. economy. One further discussion and update in the second half of this show on the U.S. GDP, updates of information that's come across here in the last couple of weeks on first quarter performance. But even before that, I want to talk about another related issue, and that is how the rich get richer in the USA. How the rich get richer. You know, economists have been aware of this growing income inequality for some time now, several years. The liberals are writing books about it, and, of course, it's getting into the press, and even the politicians are beginning to pay lip service to it. Obama in his State of Union address talked about it, and now it looks like Hillary Clinton here, the candidate for the Democrats, is focusing on it, you know, but that's, you know, don't put too much trust in what politicians say they're going to do about the growing income inequality. They're just riding the rails here and trying to get some traction on the issue. And like all politicians, they'll say things that they think you want to hear, and then they'll go off and do what they want to do anyway. So, but the point is, it's hitting even the political level here, this income inequality, and everybody's aware of it. Okay, but are you aware of how it's happened? You know, if you listen to even liberal economists and the press, what you'll get will be, oh, we didn't raise the minimum wage enough, or oh, you know, the problem is people aren't, workers aren't productive enough. They need more education to be more productive, and that will raise their incomes. Oh, maybe, you know, the tax system is unfair. It's not as progressive as it used to be. Or, oh, CEOs are making too much money. Well, all that is true. But all of that, or either that or all that together, does not explain how it happens. How does the rich get richer? What is the process? What are the mechanisms by which that occurs? Well, in order to understand that, you've got to understand how corporations got richer. Because it's the corporations where the money is made, and then the money is funneled out to their shareholders. And then the individuals get rich. See, that's where you have to look. You have to look at corporate America, because that's the origins of it all. And, of course, liberals don't want to go there, because liberals are Social Democratic Party, generally, and Democratic Party relies on contributions from, guess who? The corporations and the rich to run for office. So, you know, they don't want to poke that beehive too much here. You know, that includes liberals like Paul Krugman, you know, his New York Times column, and, you know, others like Stiglitz and so forth, you know. They're content to talking about the dimensions of the problem, not the causes of the problem, which lay in corporations. Well, let's look at this question. How do the rich get richer? Okay, some facts here. Since June 2009, which is generally assumed to be the official end of the recession, what's that? That's 6 years ago almost. Since that period, the wealthiest 1% households in the U.S., now write this down, captured 91% of all the net income gains over the past 6 years. Well, actually 5 years, 5.5 years, because this data is based on through 2014. Okay, so 91% of all the net income gains went to the 1%. Isn't that an amazing statistic? Well, you know, compare that to the 1% during George Bush's period. Okay, George Bush in office, the wealthiest 1% got 65% of all the net income gains. And before that, under Clinton in the 90s, they got 45% of all the net income gains. In other words, the whole economy generating more income over, you know, what was before. How much of that new income, that growth of income, goes to whom? Goes to the 1%. Well, under Obama, since 2009, 91%. Well, where do I get those figures from? Well, those figures are from a reputable source. They're from the ELSA database at University of California, Berkeley, which has been constructed by Professor Emmanuel Saez, who is a professor of public finance there. And way back in 2001, Professor Saez got his hands on IRS income data and constructed this database, which shows how much the 1% of total national income they've been accruing for themselves since the passage of the income tax back in 1914. Okay, and that database shows that the wealthiest 1% had an income gain, a share of total income of about 24% total income here in 1929. That income share declined during the 1930s and the 1940s under the impact of collapsing capital asset prices, you know, during 89% decline of the stock market from 29 to 35. And then in World War II, they got taxed heavy to pay for the war. And so their share of total income was only 8 to 9% by the end of World War II. That share remained the same all the way up until the late 1970s. 8 to 9% went to the wealthiest 1%. Now, that's the total share of all the income that was earned in the economy each year. So for over 30 years, their share remained 8-9%. Well, that doesn't mean that they didn't gain any income, because their absolute level of income grew, but it grew for everybody else as well. You know, all boats were rising during that period, and all groups, working class and capitalists, were gaining income. So the shares remained the same. But ever since the late 1970s, especially since Ronald Reagan came into office, but it began under Jimmy Carter in late 70s, you know, this income share has risen, and it's risen up into the 20th percentiles once again. And by 2007, it was back up to 22-23% of all the income. Oh, and then we had the collapse of stock and capital assets for, you know, about a year there when the crash set in 2008-09, and their total declined a little bit, but it snapped right back in 2010-11, and ever since then, it's been growing, and it's over 20% of the total income. Now, that's different than how much of all the net income have they been gathering for themselves, the net income, the incremental change over the previous levels of income. That's the 91%. 91% of all the net income gains, 22% of all total income goes to the wealthiest 1%. Now, liberals and others don't go where you need to go to explain how this all happens. They don't go to the corporation, because that's the source of profits. And if you look at profits over this period since 2009, what do we see? What do we see in terms of corporate profits? What we see is the following. In 2008, the total profits earned by corporations was $1.3 trillion and change. Okay, $1.3 trillion. By 2014, it was $2.4 trillion. Now, that's not simply a $1.1 trillion gain. No, no, that's every year. So, in other words, you get $1.3 trillion in 2008, and then it grows to $1.5 trillion in 2009, and then, you know, $1.7, $1.9, $2.1, so on and so forth, up to $2.4 trillion, almost double. But if you cumulatively add it all up, it's a $3.8 trillion gain. Corporations, $3.8 trillion of gains since 2008 or June 2009, since the end of the recession. Almost $4 trillion they put in their pockets, the corporations, net incremental over that particular period. All right, so, you know, 3.8, 3.9, whatever it is of corporate profits, net gain in corporate profits over this period. Now, it's important to understand what kind of profits those are. You know, you think, well, companies increase their profits either by selling more, of the whatever goods that they're selling, or by raising the prices of those goods, or both, right? That's normally what people think. Oh, well, there's a third way to increase your profits, and that's just to cut your costs, you see. I may not sell more. I may not be able to raise prices. but I can cut costs and increase my profits. And that's what we call profit margins or operating profits. And it's this huge increase, historic record increase in profit margins that we're talking about that explains this growth from $1.3 trillion to $2.4 trillion here last year. Okay, it's profit margin growth, cutting costs. Now, most of the cost cutting is labor costs, wage costs. You know, increase productivity and don't share it with your workers, or convert your workers from full-time to part-time, or get rid of paying employee health care and reduce your pensions, dump your pensions, all those other costs. You know, there's all kinds of ways that corporations cut costs and have been. They're getting very good at that. Taking it out on their workers. In other words, taking from workers what they should have gotten their share and adding it to their profit share. That's really what's going on, you see, in the last 5 and 6 years. That's how most of those profits have been generated, their profit margin cost reduction profits, not so much from sales, because we know the economy and consumption has not done all that well for quite some time. We've been bouncing along the bottom. Consumption, you know, retail sales goes up a little, falls a little. So it's not from selling more. It's from cutting costs. Okay, so hold that thought. And that $3.7 trillion or so in extra profits. Now, how do the 1% who are households, who are people, right? We don't. When we say the richest 1%, we're talking about people and households. We're not talking about corporations in the 1%. But it's the corporations that then take that trillions, multi-trillion dollars and pass it on, distribute it to the 1%. How do they distribute it? Well, the main ways of distributing that money is through dividend payments to the wealthy stockholders, and stock buybacks. In other words, these corporations are going into the market and buying back their stock from whoever holds it. And, you know, it's really the wealthy 1% who hold most of the stock. Like 90% of all the stock is held by the richest 5% in this country. If you have stock, maybe you have a little bit in your 401k plan, and you don't know what you're doing with it anyway, and you're probably losing money. So, you know, it's the investor class. It's the 1% who own most of this stock. So when the corporations buy back the stock, they're really getting paid by the corporations, the 1%, to buy their stock back. And even if they don't sell it right away to the corporations, you know, just the corporations buying back their stock drives up the price of that stock even more, makes it even more valuable, so later you sell it, right? And that's why the stock market, the Dow Jones, is at 18,000, which is, you know, three times what it was in 2009. It's at 18,000. The NASDAQ, the tech stock stock market, is at an all-time record high, over 5,000. I mean, these are bubbles in the stock market, huge, driven up all these costs. And why is it driven up? Well, it's not because these companies are doing so good just on their own. It's because they're buying back. The demand for the stock is driving it up. And it's also because speculation going on, you know, mergers and acquisitions activity and all this stuff is driving up the stock market. And there's you know, bubbles in the stock market in the U.S. And at the same time, companies are not only using their profits to drive up their stock prices through buybacks and dividends, they're actually going out and borrowing money, issuing their bonds, raising even more cash to buy back their stock. And that's what's keeping the stock market artificially in this bubble range now for the last 2 or 3 years. It doesn't justify those valuations, but, you know, all the huge profits and all the borrowing, so selling bonds and so forth, has put a huge cash trough in the hands of these corporations, and they're buying back huge amounts of stock and dividends. Well, let me give you some numbers here you know, the dimensions of this buyback and dividend payout thing. It'll boggle your mind here. You got a pencil? All right. Here's some numbers for you that'll, you know, really explain how the rich get richer and how the 1% get 91% of all the income gains. Okay, here we go. All right. In 2004, let's go back a decade here. In 2004, and I'm just going to now give you numbers for the Standard & Poor's largest 500 companies. I'm not even talking about all of corporate America, just the S&P 500. So the numbers are actually higher than this. In 2004, S&P 500 brought back $197 billion worth of stock. $197 billion. Okay. In 2010, okay, this had risen to $299 billion. $299 billion. There was a little dip in 2009 because the stock market collapsed, whatever. But, okay, $299 billion in 2010. 2011, that rose to $405 billion. 2012, $398 billion. 13, $475 billion. And last year, $553 billion in stock buybacks. It's estimated this year that's going to rise another 16%. So $600 billion more in stock buybacks this year are bound to occur. Okay, that's a lot of stock buybacks, isn't it? I mean, we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars every year. Now, on top of that, you've got to add the dividend payouts. Okay, in 2010, it was $206 billion, and that rose year after year, and last year it rose to $350 billion in dividend payouts. Okay, so last year we've got a combined dividend payouts of $350 billion and stock buybacks of $553 billion. That's $903 billion of stock and dividend payouts last year. $1 trillion almost. This year, forecasts are it will easily exceed another $1 trillion. If you add up since 2009 these stock buybacks and dividend payouts, it's just about what these corporate profits were. Yeah, just about $3.7 trillion. And stock buybacks and dividend payouts equal to the net profit gains of the last 5 years. Now, when I said profits of $3.7 trillion cumulatively since 2007, that's not the total profits, you see. That's when the government figures that say profits from sales of goods and services. That does not include profits from financial speculation by corporations, what we call portfolio investment profits. That's at least another $1 trillion by corporations. So really, it's $5 trillion of profits, total profits in the last 5 years by U.S. corporations. Oh, just the largest Standard & Poor's 500 of them, $5 trillion. How much in stock buybacks? 3.7, 3.8 trillion in dividends, 3.7, 3.8. So $5 trillion in profits and 3.8 in payoffs, dividends and so forth, and stock buybacks. That's how the rich get richer. That's how the 1% makes all its money and its income gains. It's buybacks, it's dividend payouts. In other words, the corporations make all this money from speculating and squeezing wages and workers, and then they pass it on to their wealthy shareholders through buybacks and dividends. And that's only the wealthiest 500 of them, 5 trillion and 3.8 payouts. Now, that means that they still have a lot of money sitting on their balance sheet. You know, they made 5 trillion. They paid out 3.8. They should have about 1.2 trillion cash on hand, plus whatever cash, additional cash they accumulated by selling bonds. Well, you know, you look at the S&P 500, they're sitting on about 1.3 trillion in cash. Well, that kind of adds up, doesn't it? 3.7 payout in dividend stock buybacks, 1.3 trillion sitting around in cash, 5 trillion in total profits. Oh, but by the way, that doesn't count the profits that they are keeping, the multinationals are keeping offshore in their foreign subsidiaries and refusing to bring back because they don't want to pay taxes on it, even though law says they have to, but they're not being prosecuted. Oh, that's another $2 trillion that they've squirreled away in their offshore tax shelters and offshore subsidiaries. It's not even tax shelters. It's totally legal, you know. They just park it in their foreign subsidiaries. And so that's, you know, trillions more. So they pay out $3.8 trillion. They keep $1.2 trillion, $3 trillion on their balance sheets in the U.S., and the rest they store offshore and to the tune of several trillion. That's how the rich get richer in America. Oh, but, you know, you won't read that in Paul Krugman's column, will you? No, no. You know, it's, it's the tax system. Well, yes, the tax system contributes to the whole scenario and the process. In other words, it allows, when the stock buybacks and capital gains are pushed out to the wealthy 1%, it allows them to keep most of it. They then don't have to pay taxes on it because what do you got? You got capital gains tax of 15%, the dividend tax of 20%, you know, whereas the average worker or somebody, making $100,000 to $150,000 family income, you know, they'll pay 25% or even higher in the tax bracket because that's wage earned income. But these wealthy folks get to pay only 15%, and that's before they put their tax lawyers on it and plug in all the loopholes, and they end up, you know, maybe paying 7%, 8%, and the rest of us are paying 25%, you see. So, yes, the tax system enables this whole process, but it doesn't create the process. It's not the fundamental origins of the problem, which is corporations. The tax system just enables the rich to keep more of what the corporations push to them. So it's not the cause, but they'll make you think it's the cause by talking about it. And that way, you know, you can tinker around reform, tinker around the edges of the problem, rather than going after the source of the problem itself. Or, you know, if they're conservative economists and commentators, they're even worse. They say that, the income inequality is because you, the worker, you're just not productive enough. Oh, why aren't you productive? Because you don't have enough education. So let's go to school again and get educated. You'll be more productive and you'll be able to increase your share of income. Well, you know what that is? That's blaming the victim for the problem. That's what that is. Oh, it's your fault, worker. It's your fault you're not rich. It's not my fault that I'm stealing from you and lowering the tax rate so I can keep more of it and, you know, buying the stock and bonds and dividends and getting the payouts. No, no, that's not the reason. You're the fault. Or they say, the CEO compensation is the reason. Yes, of course, CEO compensation, you know, is obscene. CEOs typically make 400 times what their average employee makes today, U.S. CEOs. It used to be, in 1980, 35 times. Now it's 400 times they get to keep. It's a problem, but, you know, if you add up all the CEOs, not just the CEOs, but the top five managers, you know, the senior VP of finance and marketing and all that stuff, the top five guys in public corporations, if you add them all up and their increase in compensation, it's still less than 5% of total profits. Still less than that. It's obscene, but, you know, it's a drop in the bucket compared to what's pushed back to the wealthiest 1%. And also, the same thing, you can, and liberals say, oh, we got to raise the minimum wage. Yes, it's terrible. The minimum wage has dropped 50% of what it was in the 1960s. It's a problem, and it should be raised. In fact, it should be doubled. It should be $15 an hour minimum, And even if you raise $15 an hour for somebody, you know, from the $7.25 per hour minimum wage, even if you doubled it, you know, the 15, they'd still be living in poverty. They'd be at the top of the threshold of poverty instead of in the middle or below at 7.25, right? So $15 is, you know, a big improvement over 7, but folks are still, you know, on the edge of poverty with that $15 an hour. You know, and we're arguing about that. So how many people will be affected by that? About 10 million. 10 million at the minimum wage level. Not a small number of people, but, you know, not big when you look at we have 157 million people in the labor force. So 10 million, if you raise the minimum wage, okay, it'll have a little effect, but it's not going to have a big effect on the income inequality. You see, all these proposals are designed to distract folks, to distract them into incremental reform on the margin of this, you know, of the tax system, on the margin of compensation for CEOs, on the margin of minimum wage. But none of it really addresses the fundamental problem. And the fundamental problem is the corporations are gouging the hell out of their workers and stealing trillions of dollars and passing them on to their wealthy stockholders through buybacks and dividend payouts. That's the fundamental problem. And, of course, you know, it's not just squeezing wages and so forth anymore. Increasingly, it's about speculating in financial assets, portfolio profits, which are at least a fourth of total profits here. You know, the $1 trillion of the $5 trillion. So, you know, there's a twofold problem here. They're speculating more and more. And, you know, a good example of this whole process here is what was announced last week. The General Electric Company, big industrial company, one of the biggest in the world, one of the largest revenue and employers in the world, you know, mainstream American company for decades here, General Electric. Well, General Electric just announced it's going to buy back its stock to the tune of $90 billion. It's going to spend $90 billion to buy back its stock because the stock just hasn't risen for the last 5 years. Even though they announced the $10 billion buyback in 2012, it hardly moved their stock. So what GE is going to do is going to sell off some of its assets and its operations in order to get the cash to buy back its stock to the tune of $90 billion to raise the stock price. And who are they selling these assets to? Oh, they're selling it to a private equity firm called Blackstone. Yeah, that's the new business model. Make money from money. Don't make money from making things and employing people to make things. Make money from other money, and you don't have to hire people to do it, you see. Blackstone owns $300 billion in assets. Right? Private equity company. What do private equity companies do? They buy up other companies' assets, and then they chop them up and sell them off and make more money that way. So, okay, Blackstone is going to buy some of GE's property assets. Blackstone owns $300 billion in assets it has bought from other companies. See, Blackstone doesn't make anything. $81 billion of that is real estate properties. Blackstone is now the largest landlord in the U.S. with more than 50,000 housing properties it rents out. All you folks in San Francisco getting squeezed out by 10-20% and more rental increases, you know, who owns that rent? Look hard, it may be Blackstone. And that's what they're doing. They're gouging people with rents now because they're buying up all these properties. So it's going to buy up the properties of General Electric as well. Not just residential housing, but, you know, other kind of commercial properties that GE owns. And GE is going to get the money, and it's going to buy back its stock. And Blackstone is going to get even richer. and make even more profits, you see. That's how you make profits today in this 21st century capitalist business model, and that is you make money from money, from other assets. You don't make things anymore. It's far more profitable to make money from money. And that's the new business model. That's Blackstone. And the old business model is GE, trying to make money from producing things, which hires people. Now, well, that's where we're headed, folks. That's the new business model. That's the new future. Okay, enough of how the rich get richer. Let's look at the U.S. economy here and what time we have left, and see if we can draw some conclusions about what's the latest figures we're going to get here for first quarter GDP coming up on the 29th of April. Now, that's the preliminary view, you see. That's the first view of first quarter GDP. There will be a subsequent view, which is more accurate, in probably around May, late May, the second view, and then there's even a third revision that comes several months after that. Usually the third revision doesn't change much, but we could get significant change between this preliminary view next week and the second view. But, okay, let's see if we can draw some deductions here. Several weeks ago, I think it was on April 4th, I said a few things about this first quarter GDP, because the indicators that were coming in for January and February showed a real deep reversal of this GDP growth we saw last year in the third quarter, this 5%. Okay, I've said for some time the U.S. economy is on a stop-go kind of scenario. There are certain quarters where we get a boost, you know, 4% GDP, but it collapses right away. It's not sustainable, and we end up with a collapse of GDP, pretty much, down to zero or sometimes even negative. Excuse me. Okay, so if you look at the U.S. economy, this stop-go scenario that I've been predicting since 2009 in my book Epic Recession would be the scenario that would be followed, and of course it has been. If you look at, we've had three different bouts, and now possibly a fourth, of a collapse of GDP of the U.S. economy. In the first quarter of 2011, collapsed to zero. Fourth quarter of 2012, also almost zero. First quarter last year, 2.2, I think it was, percent drop in GDP. And now the forecast coming in by, you know, major banks and so forth is that the U.S. economy may have barely grown in the first quarter of 2015. It could be as low as 1% this coming quarter, depending on where the forecast is. J.P. Morgan researchers are saying only 0.6% growth. Barclays, 1% growth. I think it was the Atlanta Fed that said there'll be no growth. Wow, no growth. This will have been the fourth time since 2009 that the U.S. economy collapsed to zero or less. So what we get are unsustainable income GDP growth periods for one quarter or so that are followed by collapses in GDP. And if you average them out, you know, we've got a growth of less than 2% for the last 5 years, which is about half of what is historically normal in a recovery. And we're 6 years into the, quote, recovery. And typically the average of recoveries are 5 to 7 years, which means we're getting darn close to another recession period potential if you just look at the numbers and averages and so forth. We got a weak economy. It's not sustained economic growth. We go the stop-go. We get a little boost, and we get a collapse, a little boost, and a collapse. And that seems to be the long-term scenario. By the way, we get the same short-term boost and collapses going on in the rest of the advanced economies in Europe and in Japan. Except their stop-go is at an even lower level than ours. you know, Europe go means less than 1%, and stop means negative recession. They've been in and out of three recessions. Japan's even worse. They've been in and out of four recessions. Their stop go is zero growth. That's good for them, and negative. So short, shallow recoveries followed by equally brief, shallow declines, bouncing along the bottom. And this is what it's been for 5 years, and we've never had recoveries that poor globally. It's never happened before. Oh, something's going on here. Well, what's going on is GE versus Blackstone. In other words, industrial investment in the old business model is slowing, slowing, slowing. That's why we can't get jobs going, because it's that real old business model that generates jobs. And it's not in generating investment, therefore it's not generating jobs. And the whole new future are these new industries, the financial speculation and so forth, Blackstone, the hedge funds, private equity firms, etc., on the one hand, and on these tech companies, social media tech companies, you know, Google, Facebook, so forth, that don't hire a lot of people. You know, these new growth industries just don't hire people that much. It's not like building cars and so forth, you know. People playing around with their iPhones and talking to each other and talking to machines rather than to other people. You know, that's the future here. And slowly that is causing real investment to slow from what is normal, while these other non-job creating business models grow. But that's 21st century capitalism, you see. I'm talking about all this in my new book coming out this summer, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. We'll be talking about that a little bit more as we approach the publication of that. But by the way, you can go look at what I'm going to be talking about in the book online. Clarity Press, C-L-A-R-I-T-Y Press, is the publisher. And next week I'll give folks the link and the URL on this. But you know, you can Google Clarity Press and Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, or my name, and you'll get an URL. You'll be able to go and see what the introduction is and the content and so forth, if you're particularly interested in that. But it's really about how 21st century capitalism has really changed, and the business models are shifting, capitalist business models, to non-job creating kinds of new businesses. And you know, the GE versus Blackstone is a good example. GE, you know, despite having, you know, hiring hundreds of thousands of workers and producing all kinds of things, just can't keep up in terms of its profits and stock valuations compared to companies like Blackstone and other private equity firms and so forth. So they got to sell off their assets to buy back the stock to drive it up. Okay, let's look at the U.S. economy. You know, in the last 15 minutes here, couple shows ago, I think it was on the 4th, the 1st or the 4th of April, I gave a preliminary look, an overview of where I thought the first quarter GDP was going, and it was just based on the first 2 months of the year. Now we've got more data in for March. That gives us a little better view of the first quarter. And, you know, it's worth looking at that a little bit here. As I said last time, on 4-4, April 4th, you can access that and hear my commentary then. I said that, you know, this growth in the third quarter, this 5%, was due to basically temporary, one-time-off economic developments that boosted everything to 5%, and that would fade afterwards. And okay, so what were those temporary explanations, right? Well, we had typically before an election, and last year was a national election, the government spends. You know, it holds back the money at the beginning of the year, in an election year, and then it releases it in the summer and third quarter, you know, the economy looks like it's doing really good right before elections. That's what politicians like to do. Okay. And, of course, that happened last summer as well. And that added to the boost, that 5% last year. And then during the summer, we get typically in recent years, we get this business inventory buildup as businesses anticipate, hopefully expect, a good consumer spending during the holiday season. So they build up inventories, which adds to GDP excessively. And then when the holiday season doesn't go that well, immediately after that, in the first quarter following the next year, they cut all that inventory out, and GDP goes way down. So it gets artificially built up during the summer, and then it gets artificially reduced in the winter. And that's been going on for several years now, because consumption doesn't really get going. And businesses hope that it does, and they anticipate and build inventories, and then they're disappointed, and they correct. Also, last year, you get typically manufacturing exports, seasonality in the exports that boosted during the summer, and then, of course, in the winter, it kind of slows down. But last year, we had several additional one-time-off factors that boosted GDP in the summer, and that is Obamacare. Last year, people really started signing up, 9-10 million people, with Obamacare, meaning they start spending on premiums, insurance premiums, and also they start actually using their health care. 50 million people, you know, had no health insurance at all. So 10 million signed up with the ACA, the Obamacare, and they start spending like hell last year. Well, that boosted the economy. This consumer spending based on Obamacare, healthcare spending, got a one-time boost. You know, now you pretty much got the people that are going to sign up, only 1 out of 5. We're going to spend $1 trillion to sign up 1 out of 5 on Obamacare with huge deductibles and copays. Okay, that's another issue. But anyway, that spending did occur. And then, of course, we had... into the summer, we had this continued run-up in oil, shale gas, industrial production, which, of course, began to collapse later in the year, 2014, and has continued here. But for the third quarter GDP, it was a big boost. You know, we got a boomlet going on there in shale gas and shale oil production, which boosted GDP. But now that's over, of course. Also, the U.S. dollar began rising, so that's taking a big toll out of manufacturing and exports. And we had continued big auto buying last year, and that has collapsed as well here at the beginning of this year. If you look at some of the indicators that have come in since our last show, what we see is business investment continues to contract, continues to slow down. In fact, it's been declining 7 months in a row now. In other words, ever since late last fall, business investment. And that's investment in what we call core capital goods and capital spending, business capital spending and plans. It's been contracting. In fact, in February, it contracted to 2.2%, which is, you know, the most in a couple years here. And in March, latest data show that it contracted again by 0.5%. So this business spending contraction in the first quarter is really going to take a toll on the first quarter 2015 GDP. At the same time, manufacturing and export orders are falling. So manufacturing is 12% of the economy, and if that's slowing down, then, of course, that's going to take a bite out of GDP as well as it slows down. And that's apparently what is going on. A lot of that has to do with Europe and Japan lowering the cost of their exports as they pump massive amounts of money into the economy, drives the value of their currency down, makes their exports more competitive, and they get a bigger chunk of the world market as a result, and their economies grow a little bit. Well, that's what's going on. You know, competitive devaluations by QE monetary injections. Europe is injecting, 60 billion a month in liquidity, which has driven the euro, the currency, down almost to parity with the dollar, like a 30-40% cut in relationship to the dollar of the value of the euro. Well, that's gaining them some exports, particularly Germany, which is the big export engine in Europe. So QE, increases their exports at the expense of U.S. exports. And then China is slowing down as well, big market for the U.S. So exports are being hammered, thus manufacturing is being reduced in the U.S. here increasingly over the last several months. And businesses see that, and, you know, what they do is say, well, you know, we're not going to invest and expand because it looks like we can't sell as much of the stuff now, so let's hold off on some of our expenditures. Also, the collapse in the global oil prices is behind some of this. Big investors in terms of capital spending are the oil and shale gas companies. And, of course, with the collapse of their prices, they're saying, hey, you know, we better pull back on some of our projects. And that's what they're doing as well. So business spending is slowing everywhere in the U.S. and will continue to slow due to, rising value of the dollar, due to other countries doing what they're doing, lowering the cost of their exports due to the oil shale and global oil glut collapse and other forces as well. So business spending and manufacturing spending and output is going to decline. And we're beginning to perhaps see this now affecting jobs. You know, throughout last year, jobs increased, $200,000 a month. That's not a bad increase. What's the quality of those jobs? Most of them are low-paid contingent jobs, but nonetheless, they're jobs. But now, all of a sudden, for March, 125,000. Ooh, something happened here. Oh, the bottom is maybe going to fall out of the jobs growth. You know, jobs are a lagging indicator, and we may be seeing the first look. Well, it'll be interesting to see what comes up for April jobs when the numbers come out in May, whether that declining trend is confirmed. And it seems like it may be, since unemployment claims, weekly unemployment claims are rising again for the first time in a while. So, the job picture is not all that good. What about consumption? Consumer spending. Well, what's happened is consumers seem to be saving more. If you save, therefore you don't consume. The question is, why are they saving more and not spending it? It may be because wage gains are flat for the bottom 80% non-supervising, non-professional folks. Just no wage gains, and you can only borrow so much to buy, and that's what's been going on in the auto industry. Auto's been giving cars away with free financing, pretty much. So that's all coming to an end as well. So consumption is questionable going forward, and jobs and manufacturing are slowing down, and business spending is slowing down, and it's the beginning of the year, and government spending, which usually gets bunched up later, is not contributing that much. Now, you got to ask yourself, too, why is it that in the winter, we have these four periods since 2009, we're in the winter, fourth quarter, first quarter, we have the collapse in GDP. What's going on? Well, in the last two collapses, they say, oh, it's the weather, it's so much bad, so much worse than it's ever been, and that's the reason why it's the weather. That's economics by atmospheric metaphor, and I don't buy it. I mean, what about the other winter collapses? No one was saying it was bad weather then, and the winter's always bad weather. What are they talking about? We get these storms and so forth in the winter, and it always impacts, and they're supposed to adjust that for seasonality, right, the government statisticians, which they do and everything. There's real explanations for this that have to do with, as I've said here, have to do with business inventory spending and exports and the movement of the dollar and all these other factors. I'm not saying that, in the winter retail sales don't go down. They do, but they're supposed to adjust for that, for seasonality, and they do. Well, maybe there's something wrong with their statistics for GDP in the fourth quarter. Maybe they need to do some fundamental revisions here in order to get something more accurate in terms of seasonality adjustments. That could be, too. But it's a fact. It's a fact that we have these winter period collapses in GDP, which I don't believe for a minute have anything to do with weather. And on the other hand, things seem to pick up in the summer, and especially before elections. They seem to pick up, and before the Christmas holiday season, 2-3 months before. So that's why we get these third quarter boosts that repeatedly occur that are followed by fourth and first quarter collapses in GDP numbers. But when you smooth it all out over the long term, the collapses with the boomlets here, what you get, nonetheless, is a well below average U.S. Long-term growth of 2% or less when you back out all the phony redefinitions of GDP they've done in a couple of years. We're still growing 1.8%, and we're at the end of the cycle of 5 to 6 years, and we're only growing half of what we should be. Oh, wow. That's kind of a portent of a harbinger of things to come, perhaps. A weak recovery after 5-6 years, only half of normal, with periods of booms and bust in it, short, shallow booms followed by short, shallow collapses. That's the norm. That's the new norm. And after we spent trillions and trillions of dollars to try to stimulate the economy. Well, the trillions of dollars did not go into stimulating the real economy. They went offshore to finance multinational corporations' acquisitions and expansion in emerging markets in China for a while, and it's gone into financial asset speculation more and more, portfolio investments more and more, or it's been funneled back. All that money's been funneled back in stock buybacks and dividends to wealthy investors who then shuffle it off to offshore tax havens. Or it just sits on balance sheets, trillions of dollars still sitting on balance sheets and not being really put to work here in the U.S. economy to generate a recovery. That's the true scenario of what we have. Why we have a stop-go. All this trillions of dollars to bail out the banks, to bail out these corporations, everything, flowed out of the U.S., or it flowed into financial markets, most of them out of the U.S., or it's stuck there on balance sheets, not going anywhere, not really being vested to create jobs, which means their monetary and financial policies and monetary system, central bank system, is broken. It's not working. These institutions just aren't able to generate the recovery in the economy anymore because the nature of 21st century capitalism itself has changed. It's no longer the model of General Electrics and make things to hire people to give them income to buy things. No, it's services and or financial speculation. The future is with the Facebooks that don't hire a lot of people and the Amazons that don't hire a lot of people and are soon going to replace delivery people with their drones to deliver stuff. The future is with financial speculation where money is made from money, not from making things anymore. And that's the future. That's the future of 21st century capital. Okay. In subsequent weeks, we're going to, of course, return to U.S. GDP when we get some of the real numbers coming in and see to what extent, our scenarios we've been describing here in the last couple shows with U.S. economy prove to be true or not. So we'll review this after we get probably next week. We'll have to take a brief look in part of the show next week to look at what's going on with the U.S. first preliminary look at GDP. But then I also want to turn back to Europe next week and look at what's going on with this Greek debt crisis. Will Greece default on its debt? What will happen to the $250 billion that are involved with losses should the default occur? The Germans are saying, oh, no, you guys can go. You guys can go and default and leave the Eurozone. Oh, I don't think so. I think it's going to be a bomb. There's going to be big contagion effects. So next week we want to look at Greece and the situation there. And we also want to soon, maybe next week, look at what's happening with the IMF plan in Ukraine a year after the initial IMF plan. So we'll look next week at the global economy and briefly at the U.S. economy again, once more, as we do our continual revisiting of this slowing global economy and end of the recovery here coming soon, and who knows, maybe another financial crisis. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.